My job is to talk about the disordered local moment picture, but I would like to do it given the interest in this workshop in various matters on which this story at least tangentially touch upon. I would like to develop the story in a broader context of going beyond LDA, but in a very different way than Vladimir, for instance, been doing it. It's more of a strategy than a theory, but nevertheless I would like to share it with you, and perhaps you could give me ideas to how to develop it further. These are the collaborators with whom I worked on this subject over the years. The point, let me just flash this transparency, is that there are many ways of doing many-body theory. You can, is there a pointer? Yeah. You can do correlated wave functions, BCS, Laughlin. Canonical perturbation theory, you draw diagrams to do this trace. Or you can do path integrals over Grassmann fields or Bose fields. And yet another is the density functional theory. And one can mix them if one wants to, but it has to be done with some care because they don't match into each other. Each has its virtues and its... I already took your name in vain, but I'll mention you again, Vladimir. So they all have its advantages and disadvantages, and I'm trying to stick to the density functional theory language as much as I can, although I would like to attack some of the problems that people attack in different ways. However, as you will see, I will not do, for instance, photoemission and excited states, that was of interest to Vladimir, but stick rather to the ground state problems. Because in previous talks there was a certain amount of discussion about density functional theory, maybe I thought, maybe not just now, I will say what the density functional theory is. Before that, I want to just emphasize that density functional theory is an extremely versatile approach. You can do relativistic density functional theory, which we often do, finite temperature, which we also do, time-dependent density functional. What? There is a theorem for the grand potential, which is the same as the ground state theorem, and you'll see a little bit of it during the talk. But it's in a way, most of my talk will be about what to do at finite temperatures. And then time-dependent density functional theory, multi-component, you can say protons and the electrons, and it's a density functional theory. Classical density functional theory is an extremely powerful tool to do statistical mechanics for liquids and complex liquids and the like, and even relativistic field theory has been formulated, and all the resummation of the diagrams can be involved. So it is a proper many-body theory. Dynamical for relativistic field.
You want to conserve energy, I assume.
Time-dependent density functional.
Yes.
There is a time-dependent density functional. You have functionals of the time-dependent densities or time-dependent currents, and they are actions instead of the free energies. You write down an action and you minimize. That's the. It's essentially the same spirit. That's right. But in the time-dependent density functional theory, you don't have free energy, but you have an action. It's for non-equilibrium properties. Yes. So that's what properly you need to do if you want to do excitations, non-equilibrium things. That's what you would have to do I don't want to spend time on it, but all right, yes, fair enough. It is nevertheless important to say that for most of the general problems, there is a way of getting started in density functional theory. Now, density functional theory is there's the theorem and all that, but it boils down to the minimizing that there is an energy or a grand potential functional, which is a functional of the charge density in the simplest case, and you minimize it, and the minimum is the ground state or the equilibrium state of the system. And the minimization procedure boils down to solving a Schrödinger equation in which there is a potential functional. It's a potential function which is a functional of the charge density. And in a crystal, this potential consists of external potential due to the ions, the Hartree potential, and exchange correlation. It's a relatively small contribution compared with all these, and one of the reasons why the system is that why this thing works well. And the procedure is, and this is important because this will reoccur over and over again, is that what you do is you assume a certain charge density and calculate the potential, provided you know what this functional is, and then you solve the Schrödinger equation and recalculate the charge density, and you go around in this self-consistent field of calculation. And this is the kind of thing that we can do very well now. And nowadays, if the potential functional is chosen, then most any band theory will come to the same result after a certain amount of iteration, a certain number of iteration. I will take a particular kind of ways of doing the band theory, and this is based on the KKR and KKR CPA, which have some very special properties, but I don't wish to suggest that in solving this self-consistency problem, other methods wouldn't get exactly the same answer. I just would like to emphasize that with this method, I can have more insight into what's happening in the system.
Are you defining PXC since it's being all local in space? I mean, PXC is delta squared B is C by delta
this,
N of R delta N of R prime.
This?
No, only about
the yes.
Delta N R
delta N prime. Yeah, no, let's, right. Yeah. And but the exchange correlation potential then is the same function. It's a function, not a functional, of N of R. And this function is determined for the case when the N is a constant, namely Jellium. So you have an exact quantum Monte Carlo solution to the problem, spin polarized problem. But interestingly, for instance, the relativistic version of this is not known. Nobody has succeeded in doing relativistic quantum Monte Carlo calculation. I tried with a stint a few years ago, but we got up to 14 electrons and couldn't get any further. You can't carry it, do it for enough. I mean, the usual fermion sign problem and etc. Yes. Yeah, we worked together with Roberto Carr I think we. In any case, that's LDA. So now everything is determined, and the great virtue of the density functional theory is that you can implement it under a variety of circumstances, even when you don't know what the answer is going to be, and trust that the result is sensible to the extent that LDA is known to be sensible. Now. And the question is, how do you do better than this? And under some circumstances, you definitely have to do better than this. The metal insulator problem, as we saw it before, is a case like that. And now I'm going to consider another case like this. And the other case where you must do something better than that is... Is finer temperature... Magnetism, where instead of the the Schrodinger equation I showed before. You have the potential, which is a functional of the charge density and the magnetization density, and then superconductivity. You get the same kind of problem where instead of the magnetization density, you have the pairing amplitude, and then you have a boogaloo of Degen type of Cohn-Sham equation equation to solve. Yes, there is an exact theorem, and everything works out. You break the gauge symmetry as opposed to the rotational symmetry in a spin space, and then you arrive at the same thing. And it is very interesting. I will comment on the fact that many things that happen in superconductivity is somewhat similar to what happens in magnetism, as indeed the negative and positive U-Hubbard model already know, people already know. This, but this has an analog here. So what does one do in the spin density functional theory? So this is what has been practiced for some 30 years. Using LDA for the local functional, one solves for the Green's function instead of the wave function and recalculates the charge density and the magnetization density. And when you converge, the energy bands split. And most, very frequently in the case of iron, this is a rigid splitting, but this is not always the case. And then you are in that sort of Hubbard U type of regime, and the up band and the down band and the Fermi energy somewhere here means that the system is magnetized, the symmetry has been broken, and all this time it was assumed that the magnetization is points in the same direction. Now the moments work out all right, and not only in iron and nickel they work out in reasonable agreement with experiments, but if you can, if you do alloys, disordered alloys you do with the KKR CPA, and to which I come back later on, but you get the moments right at zero temperature, agreeing with experiments for in between iron and nickel.
Can you comment on, you had a little comment on the previous assumption
of the finite temperature and the Curie temperature? Yes, this is what I'm going to come to. So the zero temperature, we are doing all right. Palladium is not magnetic, iron, cobalt, nickel is magnetic, so there is a variety of cases which you can say it's success because we get the magnetic ground state, while in the case where you don't want to get the magnetic ground state, you don't get ground state. So, but at finite temperature, it's a total failure, this story.
How is the ordered moment related to the local moment?
Well, this is at zero temperature, they are... There's only one moment, namely the total magnetization divided by the number of atoms. That's the call I call the saturation moment, or that's what experimenters call the saturation moment. Now, at high temperature, as you will know, there is a Curie law. Chi to the minus one comes down as a function of temperature, and this is the Curie temperature, and the slope here depends on the effective moment squared. That's a one on T dependent, and that slope is another moment other than the one that you see in the ground state, and experimentally those two moments that don't seem to be the same, and to the extent they are not the same, it's an experimental signature that we have itinerant magnetism, not a Heisenberg model, where in a Heisenberg model those the moments of this moment that comes from the slope and the moment which you get when they're all lined up should be the same.
If
I do the calculation as I described, and namely do the density functional LDA and the finite temperature version of LDA, which all it means is that you include the Fermi factor in here. And then you go around in the same way. That's the only way the temperature enters in. Can I finish it? I'm coming to to your points. I think I understand what you're asking. But you see, one of the main things that happens is that above the transition temperature. This is the average magnetization. And in the density functional theories, it's always the average charge density or equilibrium charge density, equilibrium magnetization. Above TC, this is zero. And we have the ground state calculation. So there is no magnetic moment. Magnetic moment is zero above TC. So there is no Curie-Weiss law at all in LDA straight. The transition temperature works out in the case of nickel about a factor of 10 larger than the experimental value. Now, Eschring and everybody else, as I will also in a minute, do something else. This is the simple, straightforward density functional LDA result. Now, you can calculate energies of non-uniform states, and then you will see that you can pick up something, a new concept, something that is like a J, and that will come down to where the experimental number is. Was that the... Yeah, okay. So, but if you just follow the straight, the finite temperature LDA, and that's what the LDA, the density functional theory tells you to do, then this is the answer, and there are no moments. So the whole thing is a disaster, no Curie-Weiss law, the transition temperature is wrong, and you can see it. Why? Because the magnetization, because this is a function, and this has to be zero, and so there is no way of fixing it up.
Uniform in space, what you're basically saying is thinking about non homogeneous configurations, and LDA is that you're sort of getting the right energy for them.
No, it's I can change this, but it will go to the lowest state, and it will go back. If you started out with a inhomogeneous, it will go back to the equilibrium state. So the self-consistent solution will be A is homogeneous, B is zero. That's not LDA.
LDA is really defined as consistent, right?
This is the proper LDA. You have to go around and solve the problem. Of course, one knows why this disaster is befallen of us. The physics is missing. Is that during this time I forced the magnetization to be all in the same direction, and this method, and that's what finite temperature LDA, local density approximation, not density functional theory. Density functional theory would perhaps have another functional, but LDA is telling you that's what you have to do, and you fail, because the only way you can lose the magnetization is that the magnetic moment per side goes to zero. And it goes to zero, and that's how you lost the magnetization. That's the... To put it another way, the only way that the entropy that destroys the magnetic order is the creation of particle-hole pairs. And there is no entropy associated with the misalignment, which we know so well from the Heisenberg model. And obviously the first thing is to put the Heisenberg-like configurations back into the problem, and then presumably one gets the better answer. And that's... There are all electrons included. Core all the way to... It's not a... You can do it there. Now, the point is that these are wonderful, these fluctuations about the line state that we are looking for, and fluctuations are strangers to density functional theory. Density functional theory is all about functionals of the averages. And the two great paradigms of theoretical physics, on the one side you have a Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson type paradigm, where you calculate the partition function of the free energy, there's a log z, which is a functional integral over some action, and you get the mean field theory, or sort of halfway there, by minimizing the exponent here, and that's what your mean field result is, evaluating the action at the minimum. If this is not good enough, Landau student claimed that Landau always told them what they had to do, but we have to wait for the 60s until this was fully developed procedure. But anyway, you expand about the mean field and you do Gaussian integrals. You have to do better functional integrals, but with the same relatively simple action. It's a simple polynomial. Now, density functional theory is very different. There you have a grand potential functional, but you don't do functional integration, you only do minimization. And the minimization we are very good at doing, you minimize, and if you have the mean field theory, you use LDA. Classical quantum mechanical relativistic, there are always LDAs, and you do the LDA, and if that's not good enough, you have to be looking for a better and a more complicated functional. So it's not in a conceptual framework of density functional theory to fluctuate. That's why introducing effective Hamiltonians and then solving them in some other way is one of the options that you can do, because that way you can introduce fluctuations. Now, I want to introduce fluctuations in a different way, and that's what's my. How to introduce the you know what we want to do. We understand that there are local moments in iron, cobalt, and nickel. And what is a local moment in these system? A local moment is always a question of time scale. It's the average of the magnetization in a unit cell in the appropriate dimension, direction, E sub I is a unit vector here, over some time. And the point is that we say that the magnetic moment, of course, there is a magnetic moment even in sodium, if you're looking at it from 10 to the minus 16 seconds. That's the moment of the resident electrons. But that doesn't lead to metallic magnetism. What you need is a magnetization which is non-zero for times long compared with the hopping time to the nearest neighbors. During that time, thousands of electrons come to that site and go away, but the correlated motion of these electrons maintains this moment for a long time, for a much longer time than the other time scale, another time scale in the problem, but short compared with a spin wave or a thermal fluctuation time. And that's the moment, we would try to capture. In other words, there is a slow degree of freedom among fast degrees of freedom, and this is what allows the ideology to be developed here to go forward. That's what we would like to base our theory on. The idea is that you constrain the system. The idea is simple, that I try to find the trace of e to the minus beta h, and you do it in two steps. You constrain the system, and you trace over the electrons subject to the constraint, and then you sum over the constraints. The constraints can be defined, now to get practical, is that the magnetization in every unit cell, it points in the same direction within that unit cell. It's a unit vector E sub I. And so I demand that the average magnetization when I integrate over the unit cell, the transverse direction will give me zero. So this is my constraint, that this has to be true on all sites. And when I... I can do any constraints, and let me do, I make this constraint, and then I claim that the trace, the Z that I'm looking for, is summing over constraint with e to the minus beta, the grand potential for the system with the appropriate constraints.
So, basic assumption is that there are slow modes in the system, which are entirely spin-like. Right? I mean, suppose magnitude and orientation of spins is what's called by constraints and
In fact, I'm even identifying what those modes are. They're not some general modes, they are the local moment.
But why is it a little bit faster than spin wave?
So because this mode, this magnetization is maintained for a long time compared with one electron, and then it moves. for instance, to be a spin wave. So to be a spin wave, or flips over. And the flipping over has the entropy, and that's the entropy that was missing from the theory in the first place. And there we are.
But presumably the reason you do this is it's somehow easier to calculate the constraint.
No, it's well, you will see in a minute. It's now here is a few lines where I try to develop what a reasonable, a rigorous theory. Okay, so the point is that the constraint solving with the constraint, I will get an exponential here, and the meaning of this exponential is that it is the trace of e to the minus beta a over all the electrons. Most of you will recognize that's the natural definition. So all I'm doing is doing what I said I would do, is that I first trace over the electrons with a constraint, and then sum over the constraint. And
in the problem of this case, it's about spontaneous symmetry.
Yes.
And so if you then sum up over all Ti, you have a state without
But I sum up over, of course, I sum up over only half of them, the usual thing of doing the traces for statistical mechanics. The point is that once I get there, all I'm doing is statistical mechanics, and in this case for classical spins. The point is how to find this quantity here, which I get after the trace, and this is just a formal expression. It's just words. It doesn't tell you how to do. Well, formally there is a nice way of doing it. You can look for a density matrix, in which I specify the orientation on all sides, and if I have such a density matrix, then I can calculate the magnetization, and then. And this is such a density matrix that when from it I calculated the magnetization, it will satisfy the constraints. How do I find such a density matrix? Well, density matrices are usually found by taking this famous functional and minimizing it. This is how the Gibbs ensemble is found. And if I minimize this subject to the constraints, that will give me the correct density matrix. And when I evaluate the grand... Yeah? Yeah.
And
yeah.
There are six easy magnetization zones, right?
Yeah.
So you don't want to sum up all of these directly, because you consider one magnetic zone, right? Then it's just one direct.
Yeah. So that I will see only one. This summation over the spin is the same as doing statistical mechanics for a Heisenberg model, if you like, except this is not a polynomial, but it is an electronic expression.
Yeah. This assurance of sort of functional integral language of the Fermat cube, you're neglecting the time dependence of the scripture, right?
Except I'm not doing a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation for a variety of reasons that would not fit into the density functional theory. See, because that's a functional integral thing, and you could not get it into this language.
I guess the philosophical question is, if you sort of full formulation of density functional theory of this type, would it involve the time axis?
No, it wouldn't, because density functional theory can't do time. It would have to be another kind of density functional theory, which could do time, but it's non-time dependent. So allow this to be a stand on its own, and it is a rigorous business of stating that this grand potential functional minimized with respect to some grand density matrix satisfying a set of constraints. And when I evaluate this omega with that density matrix, then I found the density matrix that I have to put up here, and which then gives me the partition function whose logarithm is the grand potential for the system.
And that's again like a density functional pending E, but now you have still to trace.
Now this is what I wish to emphasize here, that this is still a full many-body theory. There is no density functional involved in here. But now the trick is that I have developed the matter this far, full many-body theory, and now deployed the density functional argument only for the constraint system. And then I will have a strategy whereby I do density functional theory for the constrained system, and then I sum over all the constraints by methods of statistical mechanics or whatever other means. That's the, in other words, these are all different symmetry states because I oriented the magnetization arbitrary way. And for each orientation, I found the ground state, and I'm summing over all the ground state energy, and you see how the story develops. So it has a coherent basis, even if it's I'm not implementing it fully. So. They are different. They are different on every side. They are different on every side.
But I mean, that's basically the same as doing a Hubbard topology and then saying, I mean, this is the saddle point.
I mean, in a loose way.
It's philosophically different.
You see what you would get. What if you did the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation? You would do the same thing with the Hartree-Fock theory. And Hartree-Fock theory, which is a nonsense for metals. This is for LDA. Honestly, we can discuss it. I don't mind if you say it's Hubbard-Stratonovich. Fair enough. I don't care. But it is. I think
the
it's.
Yeah. But in the Hubbard-Stratonovich, the time axis is very important.
Yes.
There's a much disruptive way in trying to see it, which is purely statistical mechanics, crazy.
Yeah.
Which you have to clarify, non-functional.
Yeah. So to the extent, it's not useful to say that it's a Hubbard-Stratonovich, but you will see that. That's why I showed at the beginning the list of things, and I was trying to say that this, I'm sticking with the density functional theory. I mean, there are other ways of doing things, but I think it's worth pursuing it this way.
And upon which you would be able only very crudely to keep the charge within the freedom in any
And even if it's not an improvement, even then, it is a functional integral, and I don't. This is not. Yeah. Okay. Can I? Okay. So the deploy the density functional argument for the constraint, and all the theorem you can go through and reductio ad absurdum, and it's not a very nice theorem because of that. But nevertheless, it's a theorem. It works for the constraint system, and what you end up with is a density function, the Cohn-Sham equation for the Green's function, and here is the potential on every site in the lattice, sum over I, and the potential on every site is a functional of the charge density, which depends on all these orientations for which I have constrained it. And this is the charge density that I calculate from this Green's function, from which I get both the magnetization and the charge density. This is the density matrix in spin space, and it has the charge density and the magnetization density in it. And I have to solve this subject to the constraint that I described here. And so now I have separated out what I think is the slow and the fast degree of freedom. And if these orientations are indeed slow degrees of freedom, I will find out at the end, because what I'm trying to, what will happen now is I fix these orientations and ask the system to polarize itself if it wants to. And while we know that if they are all lined up, it may polarize itself and lowers its energy. But when they are not lined up, they may not wish to polarize itself. And in that case, you lost the local magnetization as a collective variable. And in general, the situation is, or what I imagine is that in a big phase space, the way this many-electron system works is that it stays around one of these orientational configurations for a long time, and then it moves to another one when some of them flipped over, and then stays there for a long time and goes to another one. So the local motion, the fast degree of freedoms are dealt with density functional theory and LDA, but the summing over all these more or less stationary points are done by other methods.
Two questions. I mean, this
successful exploitation to say as the common one generalized to inner material.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Second question, isn't it so that the case for exploitation should in principle also be a function of temperature?
Well, in principle, it should be function of everything. But I'm just I do LDA for I said I did LDA. The one LDA, what? No, it's the potential functional is on every site. And it's only the exchange correlation potential depends only on the charge density and the magnetization density, and that depends on these orientations. But you just plug it in, and that's what it is. It's a function only. E sub I is the name of a site,
right.
A lattice site, and they are unit vectors, and I have to sum over all possible orientations of them.
Right. The only question we are asking, basically, you're creating some inhomogeneous vector for the electron, the Julian vector.
Yes.
So, which is not translational invariant.
Yes.
So, how do you implement LDA for problems?
That say that you have inhomogeneous distribution of E, and then you say how can we solve it? If it is conversation variant, okay, it is not.
No, the LDA is LDA is just a function of N of R. Well, you may wish to say that, but you can implement it for anything, whether you like it or not is another matter. I accept. It's universal. The statement of it is universal. The functional is universal. Now you evaluate it for a particular density, the constant density. That's the only one you know how to evaluate it. So you evaluated it in one point in function space, but it is the same one that you use on any circumstance. Yeah. All right. No, I do not wish to say that I did anything other than mean field theory. But even this mean field theory, as you will see, is. So there is no problem. I don't have to do any fiddling beyond taking LDA, but this time for this inhomogeneous system. Then I have to do the average. This summation, of course, is like doing statistical mechanics, and except for a non-polynomial effective Hamiltonian, and it's very difficult. And I will do it only in the mean field approximation, but keeping all the electrons with me. The perhaps the only comment that I want to make is. That at beta infinity temperature zero, this will give me back the LDA. So in the ground state, where I had some success, as I said, I get the same result back. But at finite temperature, this summation is very different from the LDA that one naturally guesses. The second is that this is a classical statistical mechanics, and if I wanted to include down at zero temperature some quantum fluctuations of the spins, one of the things to do would be to allow time dependence for these orientation and sum over past histories. In other words, treat them as quantum variables, and in that case I would get, instead of S squared, I would get an S times S plus 1, where that's the That's the quantum fluctuation. This is what I imagine I would get. No such calculation has been done.
When it comes to calculating transition temperature.
Yes.
For a local moment.
Yes.
Is there not a point where this approach gets into trouble?
Well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that. Now, it's. I haven't got anywhere yet with the. No. I am now. You are the second part of it. Is I have to do this sum. Let me just go. I will explain how to do this sum, and I'm going to use the CPA to do this sum. So I'm going to do. So what I do is I do mean field theory. That means that the problem I have to average this, and that means that the average of the orientational distribution is a product distribution.
The way you define the VI is a classical variable.
They are classical unit variable. No, I'm not treating them.
You're not, but you say you could.
I would have to go back and start over. Quantize them. Okay, let me not get into it. I'm not going to show any results on it, and so it's irrelevant. It's a comment. Any sort of Ginzburg-Landau type theory can be quantized. Magnetization, as Eugene has showed us, or the superconductivity Ginzburg-Landau theory, you can quantize it, and you can do the same thing here. And whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't wish to argue it at this stage. Then let me just get on with the mean field theory. So I assume that this the probability, the full probability, of course, is this exponential divided by z. But I make the approximation that it's a product. All right.
So this is basically saying they're like eigenspins.
And they're vector spins, but Heisenberg-like spins. Classical Heisenberg-like spins, but without a Heisenberg-Hamiltonian.
Yeah. Now, did you know the status of approximation?
The status of approximation is this is a Heisenberg. This would allow me to solve a classical Heisenberg model in the usual way.
Same way.
I'm proceeding in a time-honored fashion of how to do mean field theory. And each one of the, I parameterize each one of the local probability distributions. It's different on every side. There should be an I here. This is the distribution of the orientation, and I parameterize it in terms of the average magnetization. Once I've done that, this is an important step. The magnetization is the average of E with respect to this probability distribution. It gives you the Langevin function if you in the case of easier to see if it was Ising you would see it better than the probability of E I Z would be 1 plus 1 plus M I for S Z 1. And for SZ minus 1, it would be 1/2 1 minus MI. That would be the probability distribution.
Physical information, you see that in specific correlation.
Any local probability, any local vector would give have this form, and the M is just a parameter. I'm parameterizing the distribution, and then I evaluate the internal energy, which is the average of my electronic grand potential with respect to the product distribution, plus the entropy that I get from this thing, and so this is the usual form. Now, so that's the mean field free energy, which is now the function of these m's, which are the average values of the orientations, and that parameterize that distribution. So I now need to minimize this. With respect to M sub I. Now, this is the LDA, and averaged over the product distribution, and this LDA averaged over the product distribution, I do the average within the CPA. It's because these are independent random variables, a natural thing to do, and as you will, dynamical mean field theorists will know, it's in the infinite volume limit, it's exact, whether that matters or not, doesn't matter. It comes back to the fact that the CPA is known to be the mean field theory of disorder, and since I'm doing mean field theory on the constraint system with an LDA, so the LDA and the CPA mesh together very nicely, and they are consistent with each other. This one. Now, this is the probability distribution is different on every side. No, I don't. No. This is an inhomogeneous. The LDA calculation. You don't do it at the beginning. The theory is developed with assuming that I've done, and I'm carrying around the grand potential. And you will see at the end that I can carry out the average. They only have to average, only have to find a few averages at the end. That's why it's worthwhile not to stop at halfway. Anyway, the grand potential is calculated. It's a constrained density functional calculation for an arbitrary orientation of the constraints. Is that? No, because I have an analytic solution to this average. That's the reason. None of it. None of it. I do that. I solve the integral equation. I'm not doing Monte Carlo or summing over all orientations. I'm solving an integral equation, which is a proper way of doing statistical mechanics. In liquid state theory, this would be the equation of integral equation approach. I solve the CPA equations for the average. I have the grant. Let's say I have not calculated. I have formally defined the grant potential for all orientations, and I'm looking for its average within the CPA. And then once you find it, then I have to find the minimum, and that will be my ground state or equilibrium state. And when you're looking for the minimum, you find that that what you need is the derivative of the grand potential with respect to the local magnetizations, and that introduces the first derivative of the CPA averaged grand potential, which has magnetization different on every side, different orientation. And if I evaluate this in some ground state configuration, that's the local molecular field. And its second derivative is the direct correlation function. It's the derivative of the grand potential with respect to the densities. And this is the direct correlation function, not the susceptibility. Not the susceptibility, which is the derivative with respect to magnetic fields. This is with respect to the densities. And so that gives you the susceptibility in this general and exact form. If you had some kind of Heisenberg Hamiltonian and did the same thing to it, you would end up with a J of Q here. But here, what you have is the Fourier transform of this derivative. And now the point is that you can do for the CPA grand potential, you can evaluate this second derivative, because this is an inhomogeneous CPA. The CPA is written down such a way that on every side is the probability is different, and it's a infinite coupled set of CPA equations which you don't know how to solve, but you can take the derivatives, and then after you took the derivative, you evaluate them in the ground state configuration, at the average value of the magnetization, in which above TC would be the zero. But you take the derivative first, and then you take the average, and that's how things improve themselves. And so it is these two things that I need, the local molecular field and the direct correlation function, and that's what I get with the CPA. It would be the same. If I had a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, I could do the same thing with it. This would be molecular, this would be the mean field, it would be vice molecular field theory, yeah, exactly. It would be precise. Yeah. This would be J of Q. You recognize that susceptibility. But it is not J, it's a direct correlation function with an electronic thing. But now I have to carry out the CPA for these two quantities. And so there is still some more approximations to be made. The local potential is now a function of the charge density, which depends on all the orientations. Because I'm in a mean field approximation, I say it depends only on the local orientation and not on everywhere. Once I did that, and then I assume that the magnetization is collinear within a unit cell, so it points in the same direction, then I get the magnetic distribution like this, and the exchange field also have to have this form, and there is a orientation associated with the exchange field, and exchange field and magnetization orientation not the same because I'm not in a ground state. I have to constrain. This is the B field with which I'm constraining the system to be pointing in the particular direction that I need. I will in a minute come to this because it's a I think in perhaps I do this given that this is there an erasure somewhere? The first word in the KKR is cone. Coringa and Rostock. Coringa, cone, and Rostock. The second K. Now, it's probably important in this context to tell you how to do KKR and KKR CPA. It's a very relevant to many of our considerations. In a metal, you construct a potential around the nuclear site, and you solve the local Schrödinger equation, and it depends on R shifts for a single potential well. And this phase describes the scattering properties of the system, and you don't need to know anything more about the potential. From that, it's 1 on 2i, 2i delta L, that's the scattering amplitude, minus 1. And in terms of the scattering properties of the individual scatterers, you can construct the solution for an infinite set of scatterers by requiring that the outgoing waves from each one incident on one side would be self-consistent with the waves going out from there and from each one of them. And what you find is that in order to find the band structure, it's square root of E, F, L, M. These are the angular momentum quantum numbers, energy minus 1, delta I, J, let's say J, Q, R, J, Q, and E, L, M, L prime, M prime. This is the KKR famous KKR matrix. It's a matrix in angular momentum space. It's a Fourier transform of the structure constants, which in real space is a sum over L prime. These L stands for little L and M, and it's the Hunkel function, and the point about it is that it depends only on the geometry. on the geometry of the arrangement of the scatterers and the scattering amplitude and the phase shift is what describes the process of what happens at the atoms. For instance, in the transition metals, typically an helical's two phase shift of the energy. This is a resonant quantity. It's pi over 2. And it is this sharp resonance that gives rise to a relatively narrow D band. The derivative of this phase shift is the Wigner delay time, and that's the time that the electron spends on one site. And if there are so at the sharp just leave it like this. Now in the CPA story for lay two component system, spin up, spin down, or electron or atom A and atom B, what you do is you have introduce an effective lattice, and the effective lattice is associated with an effective scattering amplitude, which is not known. And then you consider the impurity of an A scattering amplitude put on this side or a B scattering amplitude put on this side. Let's say copper or nickel. And then you demand that the scattering from an A impurity described by this A scattering amplitude, which let's call that A on a site I, and average this with respect to 1 minus C, let's say, and let's C sub I, it's the concentration on the site I, and then it's tau B I, that this has to be the same as if all the sites were effective scattering. This is the CPA condition, and this represents an integral equation for the effective scattering amplitude. And this is for a number of years now. This has been solved for alloys, and this is the only first principles way of really doing alloy. At the end of the calculation, you can calculate the Green's function on a A site, and the Green's function on the B site, and from that you can calculate the A charge density on the A site and the B charge density on the B side. And so when you've done the calculation, you go back. So having solved the problem for the CPA, you can go back and recalculate the potential that went into this two scattering amplitude, which depends on the occupation on the side. So there will be a potential up, potential down, scattering amplitudes, and going around this until convergence. So the self-consistent procedure of density functional theory is fully implemented for this for the average system. The effective scattering amplitude turns out the interesting thing is that the scattering amplitude in general has an argon plot for a resonance. It's a circle with a centered on 1/2 here. This would be one resonance. In the case of two resonances, nickel and copper, for instance, when you solve the CPA, you will find two resonances. And the argon plots as a function of energy makes two loops, and it's away from the unitarity circle. And that is how the lifetime has entered into the problem. So the lifetime of the system is described by the fact that the effective scattering amplitudes are not on the unitarity circle, and inside is the lower complex plane in a Green's function language, and outside is the upper one, and everything is fully analytic. Goes into the averaging instead of copper and nickel or niobium or something else for a spin up and a spin down case. And so the long and short of it is that I have made three kinds of mean field approximation. I'm doing the LDA for the constraint system. I'm averaging over the randomness in the CPA. And thirdly, I have approximated the local potential by only depending on the local orientation. And so all three being consistent is the only way that you can move forward in the business. Now, the CPA has one characteristic, an important characteristic feature, that it splits the resonances when it has to, and it splits the bands. And it is basically to do with the simple quantum mechanics that when a particle wants to go from an upside to another, to a downside, and if the energy is different, then the hop takes delta t time, which is h over the w is the bandwidth, and during that time the energy doesn't have to be conserved to the tune of h over delta t, that is to say w. So if the energy difference is less, then you make the hop. If the energy difference is greater, then you don't make the hop and look for another upside. And so so when the energy difference is local exchange splitting, which is there in the paramagnetic state, is large enough, then there will be two bands instead of one effective band. And and the picture is like here, that on an upside there is a density of states for up electrons and down electrons. So the up electrons are here, and the down electrons and some energy further up. Maybe U. There is no U in the problem. Notice. On the downside, the same curve, but now represents the density of states for the down electrons, and now it's the up electrons up here. So when an electron to spin flip in the original ground state of the situation, you would have to move from here to here, but in this inhomogeneous situation, all you have to do is hop over to the next site and you can change your spin. In general, you have an inhomogeneous ground state where up electrons have large amplitude on the upside and small amplitude on the low side, and the down electrons similarly. In the homogeneous case, so this is above TC describing the paramagnetic state, what you get is the local moment as a function of temperature goes to zero at some very high temperatures, as in the Stoner model. This is iron, cobalt, and nickel, all of them, and they go at very large temperature, and eventually you will lose the magnetic moment. Some experiments in Bristol are in process where they're going to melt iron and cool it very slowly so that they trap it into the liquid state down to the Curie temperature, and we will find out whether it has moment in the liquid state or not.
This is
yeah, that's right. Well, this is 1,000. That's it. No. It's the iron. The iron is the experiment that is being done. Yeah. But now this is the paramagnetic state. Now I have to calculate the. Now, you have to. This is the state that I showed you was the state when each one of the orientations was 1/4 pi. Each one of the distribution was 1/4 pi. So it was a totally random orientation. Now then, you can allow this to be to change by a small amount, and then you inquire whether the free energy has changed. If the free energy lowered, then certain orientational direction is picked out, and at first you do it in the usual mean field approximation. In this case, we've done it we constructed the Ansager reaction field in this electronic language, and perhaps in the Ising case, you don't use the Weiss field, but the Ansager cavity field, to define the magnetic orientation. And when you solve this, this is the result what we get for the susceptibility. A, that there is a susceptibility of a Curie kind at finite temperature. You get magnetic moments fluctuating. This is in spite of the fact that I have a fully itinerant theory. The magnetic moment is chi to the minus one. Chi to the minus one. So, yeah. Sorry, the minus one is missing. So. And you see that the effective moment is not the same as in the ground state, but neither is it exactly the same as the experiment. But this is a first principles calculation. You can't do anything about it. There's nothing to be fixed.
You think that the CPA would always tend to overestimate the moment itself and underestimate
it? Well, that experience is a one-band model experience.
No, but in general, right? I mean, well, if you don't deal in spatial correlation.
Special correlation
always tends to make net measured local moments less.
No. You see,
ferromagnetic.
Special
correlation,
yeah,
ferromagnetic.
So it's
increased. Oh, I see. Right,
that's
how much you
have to grab
for
each
subject.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
And how did you estimate J exchange?
There is no J. It's I didn't have time, and I have the transparencies here, and I'm worried that I have overstayed. Is basically what I did is introduced a small change in the local probability distribution, which is pointing in a direction, picking out a direction, and calculated the response of the system. And as you recall, there is a general CPA formula you have to evaluate for the direct correlation function. And this direct correlation function is what gives you the susceptibility. I know what I... Here is a sort of interesting... two comments. One is that one calculates real energies. In this, you're doing the double counting and the single particle contribution, and you generate them from the integrated density of states, which are averaged over all spin configuration. And because it's a linear function, this can be done without any further approximation. CPA provides you with a proper average. That's the one thing. So it's not just the one particle energies. The secondly is that this is how I imagine that we make contact with the real world at the level of Ginzburg-Landau theories, and not via going through spin Hamiltonians, which requires that we make a polynomial expansion of our grand potential. What we calculate is the free energy expansion in terms of the magnetizations, and the coefficient of the quadratic term is this direct correlation function, for which the CPA provides you with a formula that you evaluate, and then when this changes sign, that's where the Curie temperature is in the mean field approximation, and then the idea is that one calculates the coefficients in the Ginzburg-Landau theory, from which you can then calculate other things of interest, block wall thicknesses and the likes. Now, just one final comment is that the sort of things that you gain in this process? Well, you have to sort of investigate what. Are there these states that are these constraint states? Are they really there? Because in this process, because I integrated over them formally using the CPA, you never seen them. So you never saw for any individual orientational configuration as you asked me to do. Yes. Well, perhaps. Yes. Yes, yes, I recalculate the potentials through both the magnetic and the electronic properties solved over, and the charge densities are changing around. But here, it's a large cluster, 500 atom iron cluster, with the little constraining fields have been calculated. This is now not disordered local moment picture. This is just investigating whether if you, with KKR, you solve a large cluster LDA. This is now doing the constrained LDA and seeing what the results. These little magnetic fields that you saw it in the formula. On every side is a different magnetic field. And please. This is now not the disordered local moment calculation. This is afterwards. This is investigating whether the states that previously I presumed to be there, and having averaged over, whether they really are there, whether the system will find a ground state when you try to constrain it.
I mean, at least if they say, you know, go to the east side of the
The CPA is much cheaper than that.
But here, let's
see the magnetic moments, the distribution of the magnetic moments and the distribution of the constraining fields. You see that this is iron, and iron is a very favorable case for the Heisenberg model to work. And so everything looking like the Heisenberg model, but there is a distribution, if I try to do nickel, for instance, and I try to take one nickel atom and rotate, force it to rotate with respect to all the others, you see that as a function of angle, the moment disappears. So they are showing that the relative orientations do influence the moment formation, and there is reason to keep the story within the language of itinerant electrons. That's basically the story. There are sort of details that might be interesting to discuss with many of you. For instance, the fact that it is these effective scattering amplitude that describe the system, and in a disordered state, of course, we find that they are not on the unitarity circle, so no Fermi liquid, if you like. At zero temperature, of course, we would get back the LDA, and then we have a Fermi liquid. But if we wanted to do something of the kind that was discussed by Antoine, for instance, then what you would be looking for dynamical mean field theories, then what you would have to do is, instead of an Anderson model, you would have to be doing the scaling in such a way that the resonant phase shifts become more and more more sharp, and then you can recover the central peak in the Brinkmann and Rice story in the middle of the Mott-Hobbit gap, just in the same way as Bozier has discussed the spin singlet state in the case of the Hubbard model. In other words, the scattering amplitudes and the angular momentum doesn't have to be very high. What is a difficulty with the tight binding Hamiltonians, that to be really realistic, you need an awful lot of orbitals. And here one doesn't need many channels. L equals 2, L equals 6, I mean, so people have done L equals 16 calculations to check convergence of everything, but you can consider F bands with L equals 3. and the basic physics can be kept track of more than, say, pseudo-potential type calculations where plane waves are beautiful things because they are universal, but when you have 25,000 of them, then you can't see much of the physics. But here, what is happening locally on the site where the moment is formed is kept before you in terms of these scattering amplitude, and you're looking at the argon plots, and you can just see whether there are two resonances and one resonance, where is an effective band going or two bands going, whether you have split the band or not. Thank you for your attention. Yeah.
You always have only one side of the correlation function, no near interside. So you could extract exchange interaction interside.
Yeah. This is spend the time on it, but it's chi of Q is calculated, and the chi of Q experimentally have this form. It's the S2. There is a formula for S2. The direct correlation function chi of Q is 1 over 1 minus S2Q, and this S2Q is a Fourier transform of the second derivative of the CPA as a function of magnetization, dmi dmj. And this, for this quantity, we have a formula which involves the integrals like k and k plus q of the kkr matrix, the inverse kkr matrix. So it does, and you see the small q dependence is very well reproduced compared with neutron scattering experiment.
And another question: did you try to apply this for Hubbard model to see when local moment appears?
Hubbard himself. Hubbard himself have done in 79 and 80. Hubbard model was introduced in the 60s, but he came back to the problem of magnetism, and he did calculations very similar to this using the CPA. It's Hubbard 3 was also in the 1960s. This is 79-80. Hubbard and Hasegawa, and they done. Yeah, they usually were single band or calculations. This has no U in it. It's just LDA. This theory, you don't have to put in a Hubbard use to go beyond and introduce correlation. And it is a general method of constraining the system and summing over the constraints. You can do time dependent problems that way, and it's an approach that has a general validity. But likely to work only when there is a slow degree of freedom. I mean, this is.
What about short range order?
That describes short range order.
But no, could you put it back into calculation?
No, I don't know how to do CPA in the presence of short-range order. Then we would be reduced to like Mark, some kind of a overall.
This is the problem.
In the CPA, if you're willing to do live with the CPA, then then it's fine. Or if you have a better way of doing averaging, but I don't.
By law, people try to reduce the sovereign and it seems that it needs to be limited.
But as you see, there are lots of cases, like where the dynamical mean theory is worked, where it's more important to take care of the local. I haven't found anything I haven't found anything that was that has any general.
Can I borrow that stick there for a minute?
Who do I give it to? I don't sell military equipment.